This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Death is most often discussed as something to fear, something to defeat. And oddly enough, the more we try to run from it, the greater hold it has on us. Maybe that explains our fascination with the living dead, zombies, vampires, and other creatures that straddle the line between life and afterlife have prowled our imaginations for centuries. The undead are fantastic fun for horror movie makers, trick-or-treaters, and teenagers.
Will you be my vampire boyfriend? I want a vampire. As a boyfriend.
Yeah, all the rage these days, but Dr. Barry Saunders takes these things a little more seriously. He's a physician and associate professor of social medicine at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He says the living dead offer us a lens through which we can examine our society's feelings about dying in an age of advanced health technology. Barry teaches a seminar course at UNC called The Undead, Bodies in Between, and he's with us today to give us a dose of what students learn in that class and what we can learn about our lives from the living dead. Barry Saunders, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
You're a medical doctor. What made you want to concentrate on the undead?
Hospital's a scary place. I went on the lam in the middle of my medical residency and came down here, actually, to do a master's degree in religious studies. And wound up in the first semester at the end of for a seminar, writing a paper on the undead as a religious category that's been populated over the eons by all kinds of problematic bodies.
So you did that. Well, let me go back and ask, what made you run from the medical profession in the first place?
Well, I didn't run from it as need some time away. Yeah. I was a little bit afraid for my imagination in the demanding routines of workshop medicine.
Well, so, that's interesting. You were and you decided to go into religious studies to make sure that your imagination wasn't what, atrophying, somehow withering away.
Yeah. And this wasn't a particularly theological track of mine. I knew some folks at UNC from my undergraduate days, and I knew this particular program in religion and culture did not ask for a choice to be made between texts and bodies and other material culture. So it was a good way to think about the hospital and biomedicine as a religious enterprise, full of rituals and priestly authority and canonical texts and all those sorts of things.
Well, that is something that had occurred to you, apparently, because it's not necessarily in the medical text yet, this way of looking at hospital life, medical life.
It's not, although it's there in bits and bits. There's an awful lot of work being done these days on medicine as a culture and medicine's difficulties in conjoining its cultural outlooks with those of lay people and clients who supplicants who come for help.
But your worry was that something was withering away, atrophying with your imagination. Why did you think that was going to be an important part of your medical career? Or did you? Was it part of it?
You know, I think I had begun to wake up intellectually in the just before medical school and in medical school. These questions of life and death that really beg for reflection. And so I was kind of riding a high of broad thought heading into residency. And then you encounter the 100-hour work week, and there's no opportunity to do that. So I took a couple of years out to come and think and read and write.
And some of the reading you did, of course, would take you to the great writers of the imagination and of horror, writers like Edgar Allan Poe.
That's right. Poe is a favorite of mine. I'm not quite done with Poe, yeah.
Yeah, well, he's not done with us. I mean, there's a lot going on there. You ask your students to read from a story of Edgar Allan Poe's, one in particular. Maybe you can tell us about it, and I'll ask you to read from it as well.
Sure, yeah. We actually start the seminar with this. It's a terrific piece. The first run at the seminar actually folded in about half graduate students with half medical students. And this is a story that is called The Facts in the Case of Monsieur Valdemar. And it's written in a language kind of stilted that got received in that day as an actual narrative of a scientific experiment in some quarters. And the notes for the story are taken by a medical student who at one point passes out in the middle of the story. So it's fun for medical students to engage this.
And tell us about that story. What's the story?
So this is a story about mesmerism, which was the rage in those days, mid-19th century. And the possible capacity of mesmerism to suspend someone in a deep sleep beyond their actual death. So they, in the story, a Monsieur Valdemar, who is has a terminal illness, makes himself available to mesmeric passes by the narrator, and so he's put to sleep and preserved for months, seven months or so. And toward the end of the story, they are in dialogue with this mesmerized corpse who's able to say, I'm dead, put me out of my misery. And the mesmerizer tries to wake him up from his sleep. And so I'll just read the very last paragraph of the story.
Great.
Which is, for what really occurred, however, it is quite impossible that any human being could have been prepared. As I rapidly made the mesmeric passes, amid ejaculations of dead, dead, absolutely bursting from the tongue and not from the lips of the sufferer, his whole frame at once, within the space of a single minute or even less, shrunk, crumbled, absolutely rotted away beneath my hands. Upon the bed, before that whole company, there lay a nearly liquid mass of loathsome, of detestable putridity.
There we are, Dr. Barry Saunders reading from The Facts in the Case of Monsieur Valdemar, an Edgar Allan Poe story, and one that he asks his students to read in a seminar that explores the undead. What do you want your students to draw from that?
Well, from the mass of putridity, only maybe some analogs for the grossness of tissue and the organic stuff that's somewhere between life and the beyond of life. The story is a great one to start with because it's had some pretty terrific commentary that unfolds by Roland Barthes, who is a literary critic who reads basically the first paragraph of the story in an entire essay. That's just a tour de force of close reading, unpacking every word, every phrase, every lexeme is Barthes' term. But this is helpful in the opening stanzas of a seminar because it informs the students, look, you're in here for some rigorous work. This is how you do close reading, or one way of doing close reading, and this story is all about close reading. And the other nice thing about this piece of Balz is that it it emphasizes one of Poe's agendas with this story and with all of his writing, which is that one of the spookiest technologies we have that enables voices to come from beyond the grave is writing itself. Poe was obsessed by this. All his texts are machines of liveliness that bring back the dead into our space.
Why do medical students need to learn this kind of close reading, this kind of critical reading of literary texts?
Well, that's a terrific question. I'd say there's a lot of energy being expended today on revision and reform of the medical curriculum. We are terrific at teaching students the importance of science and mobilizing science in the interest of patients. But there are some things that fall out, and students need to understand the storied lives of their patients, and they need to be able to read and write these qualitative skill sets have in some ways been eclipsed by quantitative metrics that occupy so much of their attentions.
And particularly when it comes to subjects like the undead, we're fascinated with this, and it's not only a matter of literature but pop culture as well. For instance, in Zombieland, the film that features this cameo with Bill Murray playing himself.
Bill Murray, you're a zombie?
Zombie, you're talking. You're okay.
The hell I am.
I'm sorry. I didn't know that it was you. You
are you? What's with the getup?
Oh, I do it to blend in. You know, zombies don't mess with other zombies. Buddy of mine, makeup guy, showed me how to do this. Cornstarch. You know, some berries, a little licorice for the ladies. It suits my lifestyle. You know, I like to get out and do stuff. Just played 9 holes over Riviera. Just walked on. Nobody there.
There we go. What are some of the other, just briefly give us an idea of what some of the literary types we're going to look at in your course?
Oh, sure. Well, beyond Bill Murray, we do some of the standards. We look at Dracula or Nosferatu. We take up Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, either with the original text or with one of the filmic renditions.
We'll talk more about those and get some more guests and some examples when I talk with Barry Saunders on the state of things, an associate professor in social medicine at UNC Chapel Hill. Our conversation about the undead continues on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking about the undead and what we can learn about ourselves from our fascination with creatures that won't die.
Hey, Simpson, I'm feeling a mite peckish. Mind if I chew your ear?
Dad, you killed the zombie Flanders.
He was a zombie?
Taken from the cartoon series That Won't Die, The Simpsons. But Dr. Barry Saunders is with us, a physician and professor in social medicine at UNC Chapel Hill. Barry's also an adjunct associate professor of anthropology, religious studies, and communication studies, and brings all of those to bear on a seminar that he does on the undead, sometimes for medical students, sometimes for grad students, and pretty soon for undergrads. And it seems to me, Barry, that when we're talking about the notion of the zombie, the undead, it's appropriate these days when medical technology has pushed the boundaries of our definitions of when life begins and when it ends, certainly.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. When I referred to the hospital as a spooky place, I was thinking in particular about some of the bodies that we work with that are suspended between life and death, connected to screens and, gas cylinders and other things all around that sustain their liveliness. But it's hard to work in an intensive care unit without girding yourself for the spookiness of some of these bodies.
Yeah, it is a terrifying. I mean, if you think about it as a place of healing, if you didn't know that that's what was going on there, if you came from another planet or another era and you walked in there, you'd think it's a torture chamber, right? It's a hall of horrors.
It is. And horror, I think, is a good thing to think with. There isn't an official outlet for the horrified resident or medical student to turn to. So this is one way of mobilizing a pretty powerful set of affects and using it to think critically about professional formations, the culture that we're indoctrinated into, the habits that we form.
Well, and another aspect of this too, I mean, the zombie is the body without the soul. And if you think about that in terms of doctors being purely, you know, medical and scientific about this, looking at the meters, the measures, the screens, and not the patient and the tubes, it's a kind of zombie healthcare, isn't it? I mean, to some extent.
Yeah, that's true. If we let ourselves become machinic, we're at risk of. I mean, that's part of where these clips that you played. And I wish I could have such deafness with the clips in my own classroom.
We'll lend you Lindsay for one day, and you'll be set for the next
terrific.
6 years.
But the person who imitates the zombie, right? This mimetic device, both Homer's confused. Really? Ned's a zombie?
What's the difference? So, and Bill Murray, who has Bill to Murray. Do that to fit in.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. So, you know, the mimetic moves are
mimetic one, meaning imitation.
Imitation.
To imitate.
Actually, yeah. To assume the gestures and postures and dress up. But Halloween's all about imitation, right? So, but anyway, this is one of the ways that humans and their dead ancestors have related to one another over the years. There's a lot of imitation of the dead.
And you bring that in. Tell us about some of the historic references that you bring in and the ways in which we have tried through the ages to communicate with the dead.
You know, well, some of this comes back. I mean, in the, you know, the canons of humanities literature, it goes back to Plato via Cicero. This maxim to philosophize is to learn to die. This was taken up by Montaigne in the 16th century, and I think is part of what underwrites a lot of this fascination with death.
And by that, learning to die, the idea is that once we become aware, this was the scariest thing that we could ever do. We now anticipate our deaths, unlike we think any other animal. We're pretty sure that we may be the only one. And living in the dread, we see what it looks like. We've buried our dead, and it's going to happen to us. How do we then cope in a world where that is the ultimate question, and that's how we all end up?
Well, it's an open question.
Yeah.
I certainly don't have an answer.
But that's,
the point of the course is to deliver 20 different answers to different cultural.
But that's the philosophic. I mean, when
absolutely.
You say learning to die, that's what Plato meant. That's what the other philosophers
sure,
meant. How do we cope with this knowledge of death?
Until very recently, a transition that we didn't have a whole lot of control over. Now we've got lots and lots of ways to orchestrate that transition. For older other cultures, it wasn't just a matter of the one-way transit from life to death. There was a real problem. How do we keep the dead, in their place? Mm-hmm. How do we keep them from finding their way back to us or troubling us? There were a lot of funerary ritual and conceptions of how to pacify, mollify, bind and gag the dead, inform funerary rituals from all around the world. There's a lot of Victorian armchair anthropology that's pretty fun to trot out, give ourselves a kind of comparative look at our own notions.
And why was that so fearful? Because another aspect of our relationship with the dead was death and resurrection, which was a very important part of human consciousness. There will be a spring, even though
they're
things
coming
have
back.
Died.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing. The seeds will be planted and a new life is born.
It can be a good thing. I mean, it has sacramental status for Christian enterprises, Lazarus or Jesus himself, right? 3 days in the tomb, and that's a pretty spooky story.
And death and resurrection was an idea that predated Christ. It was a trope and a type that was very important in that time for him to use and for the apostles to use to spread this word because people were already familiar with it, and it was an important idea.
Absolutely. And a lot of later Christian notions of what kind of value the body had, the powers that pieces of the saints had, for instance. I mean, these are undead powers, right? And so the way that Christians of various stripes treated their dead, the 19th century movement of the cemetery from the churchyard and the inner city to the suburbs, and the building of these polyglot architectural cities for the dead is readable in one way as a way of giving the dead their place to hang out and show off.
And what about how has this changed our thinking? You talked about it earlier, the fact that we seem to have a little more control over at least the timing of our death. We can stick around a little bit longer through technology. Has that fundamentally changed the way we think about dying and death, the dead body?
Oh, absolutely. probably the most dramatic example is the shift from cardiopulmonary death to brain death, coincident with the development of transplantation technologies, drugs that could allow bodies not to reject organs from deceased donors. So we not all that long ago redefined death as brain death, and there were, of course, resistances to this of various kinds. Other cultures didn't take this up quite as readily as North American cultures did. But this is the canonical death these days. That's about death of the larger organism, the self. We also have technologies that track cellular death, and that can prolong cellular life beyond the confines of you know, organism life. So you know, immortal tissue cultures, the HeLa cell line, right, and lots of others that manage to be transported all around the world and live on well past the intentions or wishes of their donors.
How much do you explore the living dead in other cultures and other societies?
Within the seminar, how much do we do this?
Mm-hmm.
The seminar tries to take up a diverse range. So from other periods, I mean, the part of the point of the seminar is that this thing we take to be timeless, the one constant in the human condition, death, is in fact something susceptible to enormous cultural and historical differentiation. So death perhaps isn't the same thing in all times and places. We look at, beyond some contemporary zombie films, we look at the Haitian zombie, and in particular an ethnobotanist's incursions into, you know, various secret rituals and supposed discovery of the major ingredients of the zombie poison.
And what does that tell us? How is that distinct from, let's say, other ideas about the undead? Talk about that and how it's distinct from other cultures.
Well, the Haitian zombie, of course, I mean, this is an element of a very interesting cluster of essentially sorcery traditions that come from West Africa, but that have a particular formation in Haiti. Apart from this, there's also the fact that it emerges from a slavery culture, a plantation culture, and some of the very concerns you expressed about this, the soul without a body, the automaton working in the fields. I mean, this is what zombies were able to do. There's a terrific essay critique of the zombie that moves it to another zone. We look at an essay by Gene Komaroff, a wonderful anthropologist at University of Chicago, on zombies in South Africa. 20 years ago, there were no zombies in South Africa. There were lots of witches and lots of sorcery and nasty spells cast. But a particular conjunction of capitalist ideologies and in particular flows of labor from outside the country began to produce some suspicions and anxieties around work and around capitalist, call it alienation. But so lo and behold, she goes back for another cycle of ethnography, and there are all these zombies and zombie lore around that were not there in a prior era. So pretty interesting stuff.
How does it affect, then, the practice of medicine? Because it seems to me that the way we understand medicine today is it's a profession designed to save lives and alleviate pain.
It's sure
not always seen that way. I mean, medicine practiced in other cultures and at other times was far broader, and it had deeper social implications as well as healing. How does a doctor take this? What am I supposed to do with the fact that you seem to be saying, look, death is something we need to understand better rather than try to simply declare war against? Isn't that – that's a tough cultural message these days in a medical school? Oh, yes or no?
It is. It's a tough cultural message. we're up against the ethos of, you know, not on my shift. You can die somewhere, but not on this ward, not on my shift. I spend about a third of my time in a community emergency room not far away from Chapel Hill. And under that hat and in that zone, that's what I'm all about. So these are lessons that you fold into your reflective practices, and you and your critical practices. I look back on my shifts in the emergency room and think about the privilege that we have. I mean, that's another piece of this, is that we aren't intimates with death as lay people in the way that we were in the early modern period or in the Middle Ages. We don't have the experience of washing our own dead. It's a lot of this is, you know, outsourced, commodified, and doctors are a part of that, the machinery, yeah, of orchestrating good deaths and taking care of the dead.
Death happens out of our presence very often. Since people are living longer, people can go a lot longer and be a lot older. You know, we're always shocked, even at my age, to see how our children and grandchildren have experienced so little death in their own families, because we're all living to, yeah, ripe old ages. And then it gets, as you say, kind of cleaned up. It sort of brings us to one of the classics in this whole genre, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. And here's a clip from the film adaptation of that story from 1994.
Did you ever consider the consequences of your actions? You gave me life, and then you left me to die. Who am I?
You. I don't know.
This is one of the challenges for modern practitioners as well as researchers. You get on this track, you have an enemy, death, you do what you can to defeat it, but you're not quite sure what the technology that allows that is going to bring.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That's a great clip to exemplify that. This isn't just about doctors on the wards, but it's about the scientists who are delivering brave new technologies to us off the laboratory bench. I mean, Victor Frankenstein's work was that of a bench scientist, and so we don't have the Victorian bellows and galvanic currents of quite the same sort. But you know, our contemporary biobanks and molecular techniques are producing a whole range of life extension technologies, cell life extensions we freeze all kinds of things. Whether frozen whole bodies are going to come back, you know, that's a long shot, I think. But there are lots of small things that are brought back after a decade in the refrigerator.
Then when we ask, what am I, we may not know the answer.
We may not know.
So yeah. When your students now, and you have grad students as well in many, many disciplines, as well as med students, and you ask them to read, think critically, and write, what are some of the more surprising essays you've received in terms of their reflections on all of these readings?
Oh, it's a terrific range. This is one of the most fun parts of the course. I give over the last several sessions to students unfolding their own findings from the archives. I've had students write about cartoon characters, Simpsons Treehouse of Horror episodes. I've had an essay on Kenny from South Park, who of course returns from the dead episode after episode and that gets explained later on. I had a student, an anthropology student, write about repatriation of Indian remains. This fascinating problem that their laws now compel remains to be offered back to their tribes from which they were removed. Some of these tribes who no longer occupy the lands where the remains were disinterred want them back and want to put them in a place with proper ritual actions, and others of them don't want them back. You dug them up. These things are powerful. You deal with the powers. Mm. So really interesting material. Yeah,
Barry, thank you so much. Fascinating conversation, and would love to take the class. Sounds great.
Thanks so much for having me.
Dr. Barry Saunders, Associate Professor of Social Medicine at UNC Chapel Hill, where he teaches a course called The Undead Bodies in Between. Our exploration of the living dead continues just ahead when we get a dose of zombified Southern culture on the skids live in the studio. Stay with us.